But in the end it worked well, didn't it? Did you listen to it?
No?
I will do, but I just can't at the moment. I need to be brave. I just don't like the sound of my own voice. But I lived with a speech therapist guy here for my first year here, and he said, what we do when we listen to our own voice, we hear the resonation of our bones. But when we hear it externally, we don't hear it how we hear it, because of the bone structure. So that can be quite a painful process. No, I just sound like some gay camp kid on helium. Thank you. So episode 2. So we're in Edgar's flat again. And I think, first of all, we'd just like to say thank you to everybody who emailed us and posted positive comments about episode 1.
I was quite happy with the response because I wasn't expecting people to get involved so swiftly. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, that's the purpose and that's the dream. That's what you want and that's what I wanted. But I didn't think that it would be so immediate.
So thank you very much for those. And if anybody else wants to comment on what we talk about in this episode or previous episodes and give us ideas that you'd like us to talk about and debate, or even if you want to join us as a guest on a future episode, please do.
Yeah, I really like that you mentioned that, because I was thinking that this being a podcast on the everyday lives of gay men, to be a guest you don't need to be... You don't need to be a writer or you don't need to be famous. You just need to have some ideas that mm-hmm. you want to share with us.
So yes, either email us or find us on Twitter or send us an email via Stitcher and iTunes. So our topics today, Edgar, are relationships, really. The nature of gay men's relationships and the difference and diversity that's beginning to emerge within romantic and erotic gay men's friendships and relationships, and the tensions that sit between those different ways of relating. And then we're going to introduce some of Edgar's research. He's recently completed his PhD on a fantastic piece of work about a sense of identity and relationship. I'll let him talk more about that.
Mm-hmm. Probably we could start with the idea of what is a relationship, or why do we make this distinction between erotic and romantic? Can a relationship be erotic and romantic at the same time, or could you find both qualities in?
I'll probably throw that question back to you to begin with, because these are terms that you use quite a lot. I think my mind goes to more sexual, non-sexual, but you go to erotic mm-hmm. and romantic. So do you want to say a bit more about how you see those terms working together and in tension as well?
Mm-hmm. I've sometimes faced a little bit of a challenge when people say, well, are you trying to romanticize this or to make it more...
Mills and Boone.
I don't know, what is that? What is that?
Those are those old romantic... novels.
Oh, I see.
That
I
your
see.
Granny used to read.
So yeah, that can be the perception that is a little bit old-fashioned, or, and that's been a comment that people have made about is it just sexual and non-sexual? And to me, it is important to say that a relationship, an intimate relationship or a loving relationship, is. That there's more to relationships than just sex. There's more to our interactions and to our connectedness than just sex. I mean, you can have a sexual encounter that is just a one-off sexual encounter, and it can be even with a stranger, with one of those hookups, and there can be a little bit of romance there. There can be a little bit of intimacy there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also possible that there's almost a mechanical encounter, but mm-hmm. I think that there is also something quite... It can be quite romantic as well. When I say romance, I'm talking about this sense of tenderness, almost this vulnerability of mm-hmm. openness and being opening up to the other person, and I think that is something quite special.
My mind goes to that film, Weekend.
Oh yes, yes, weekend, yeah.
Which is, for all intents and purposes, is a 48-hour hookup. It's originally shaped as just a sexual encounter. But then over the weekend, and it happens quite quickly, doesn't it? You know, the intensity, the invulnerability, the pain and the joy all comes through, and it suddenly becomes a romantic encounter.
Mm-hmm.
But all done in a very short time frame.
Yes.
So I guess that's a little bit about what your counter, possibly longer than those hookup encounters that, you know, are familiar from apps and websites. But
And in this film, for those who haven't watched it, I just watched it a couple of years ago, so it was quite a novelty for me, but I think those encounters seem to be quite frequent. Or I don't know if you share this opinion, but I think that there is something quite special about how you meet someone and you are interested in that person. And it can start from a sexual interest, but then you get to know the person a little bit, and then you can even fall in love a little bit.
In a very brief sexual what initially was envisaged just to be a sexual encounter.
And in this, I would like to challenge that idea that gay men are happy with just having sex, that we can have this idea of no strings attached, that I see quite often referred in the media or in forums for gay men. And I think there is a powerful force, a powerful narrative that has been said that we are happy with that. And I mean, we might be happy to some extent, and some people might like that. But I think that there are other men who like to have a little bit more than just the pure sexual encounter.
And I think I've noticed that on the times when I've used Grindr, I've got online on Grindr, I've noticed more men are now talking about wanting strings attached. Almost as if they're coming out of the closet now, you know. I'm not interested in NSA.
You know,
coffee first, I want to go for a meal. But they're few and far between. And they're seen as, in my personal view, and it's wrong, and I wonder where that comes from, is they're not playing the Grindr game, which is, you know, pure sexual encounter. But I notice that people, men, are now beginning to modify their profiles and talk about their desires. So I wonder if this is a new cultural phenomenon somehow, that we're giving ourselves permission to move beyond the pure sexual encounter, which maybe historically is what we've all been entitled to, or that has all been available to us.
Yes, and I am quite interested in knowing how that happened. If you think about heterosexual men, there have been some very powerful statements from people who say, well, men in general are just very, very sexual. And it's almost like this portrayal of readiness for sex, that you can, as a man, you can have sex with anyone or with anything. And it's quite powerful, and I like to challenge that, because that overgeneralization of men as almost predatory men.
That's why mine went to, it's almost primitive, because my background is studying biology. It's my primary degree. You know, the male species, you know, the male part of the species was the one who went and just had the sex and then left the woman to raise the children. They didn't need to invest in the upbringing, and I wonder how much of that has then moved through to humanity, and that men...
I think it's really important to say that biology, of course, plays an important role, but we are also cultural beings, and as species, we have influenced the world more than any other species, more than any other living species, and I think we can't escape culture, and culture is something that that shows in many aspects of our lives, and one of them is this. It's like discourse. When we repeat something so many times, it creates discourse, and discourse is something that is inescapable sometimes. It is you believe in that discourse, and sometimes you don't even challenge that discourse.
People aren't even aware that there is a discourse.
Exactly. It requires some awareness, as you just said, to realize that there is something. And I think for gay men, this discourse has been that we are very sexual beings. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's fine. As long as we also are aware that we can challenge that narrative and that we can access other narratives and create other narratives.
I wonder if we've not been able to up to this point. I think I'm hearing two parts to your argument. One is to break the term gay man down. So the first argument you have is man, and that masculinity, from a discursive point of view, is perceived to be sexually orientated. That sexual encounters that they can, that a man can move from encounter to counter-encounter and doesn't necessarily desire the emotional attachment that is seen as, or discursively created as, a feminine quality. Equally then, we haven't discussed it too much, but I'm then beginning to hear from you is the prefix to that, which is gay. And the gay encounters are traditionally sexual encounters that are quite short, quite brief. And I wonder if that is historically imposed upon us and comes again from our discourse in terms of, particularly in the Western world, growing up where it's not been legal. We've not been allowed to have openly multi-perspectival relationships. Then we've had to have those sexual encounters. What if you want to talk a little bit?
It has had to be very furtive and very secretive. Because if you do it overtly, then you could be sent to prison, or you could be
killed.
I mean, in many parts of the world, it is still illegal, and you can face prosecution, you can face prison, you can be
exercised from your community.
Yes, and that's what is happening in Chechnya and in Russia and many
down in Syria with ISIS. So I wonder if we as a population, because we're the only population where we have male in our title and we have gay in our title, and if we bring those two together, you know, the sexualized perception of masculinity and the need for us to be, or historical need for us as a community to be hidden, rushed in our encounters, then it makes sense somehow that over time that's how we perceive our relationships, as rushed sexual encounters. But of course, in 2018, we're open to different styles of relationship now. The legalisation of gay marriage now means, you know, you're married, so we can, you know, be in a different, have a different way of relating almost. But that needs accommodating the challenging somehow.
I think we are going through a breakthrough here, in at least in these in countries where it is legal to be gay and it is legal to get married. I think there is an interesting phenomenon here. I can see it because I've lived through different contexts when that wasn't a possibility. Being married to a man, I remember when I was 16. I had a girlfriend because I thought that that was the only option that I could have. I didn't think that having a boyfriend would be legitimate. I didn't think that that was a possibility. So for me, that was something I needed to live in secret, to live in secret. My desire for men, I would just hide it. And when it wasn't possible to hide it, when the urge was too strong, I would do it in secret. Now, you could believe that that won't happen anymore because now it is accepted and that is... But I'm quite surprised that I've come across young people. I mean, last year, just very recently, I've come across people who are in their 20s and they have gone through the same idea of living in secret.
And I think that's because we don't just exist in one culture. We exist simultaneously in multicultures. And I think about my own background, and thank you for sharing that, Edgar, in the sense of, reminded me of my own background, which is from rural England. and growing up in that microcosm culture in which gayness wasn't accepted. There wasn't any role models around for me.
Mm-hmm.
I went down a slightly different route. I more or less went down the asexual route, which was I didn't have a partner full stop, just because I didn't know how to relate to other people mm-hmm. on an erotic, romantic level, because I had no modelling to do and I had to keep it hidden. So for me, it was going online. In those days, it was gaydar.
Mm-hmm.
But that happened much later, in my late teens, early 20s. So early on, there was nothing. So I was desexualized.
I've heard many accounts like that there is this impossibility of seeing themselves as sexual beings or as partners in a romantic relationship because there is no role model. There's no possibility of doing that. And a very good friend of mine used to tell me, well, I was thinking that I would be a priest because I didn't want to have a relationship with a girl. I definitely knew that I didn't want that. So if I won't have a family, I think I will... What are my options? So in his head, at a very early age, he thought that he would be a priest. He never became a priest, but he was on his way because he was already part of the church, attending groups as a very young man, and he was already thinking of the seminar, of joining the seminar.
Now, I'm always mindful of that in the sense of how much of, when we talk about gay culture, is there is a universal gay culture, but also how much of that is metropolitan, city-based,
mm-hmm.
where there are more options, it seems to move at a faster pace, whereas I grew outside of that mainstream gay culture. I grew up in a small town and then in the countryside beyond that, and so I had a different gay culture. And my main culture growing up was that of my family, and of religion was around, but it permeated at a lower level. So I think we need to be mindful of, when we talk about gay culture, that there's people exist in different contexts.
Yes.
And you said, and I said, you know, in terms of we're aware of, both as our work as counsellors, but also our own experience, that people are still struggling. In 2018, there are still people who live in different contexts, different discourses, which for them makes gay relating difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, the struggle is real, and I think I still struggle in some ways. It's a different type of struggle, and I think it's a more nuanced one, and it's not similar in any way to the struggle that people go through in countries where it's illegal to be gay, but there is some very subtle aspect of how legitimate these relationships are, in the sense that it's getting to a point in which our relationships are seen as normal. When I say normal, I mean as common or valid. And I realized this because a couple of weeks ago, a colleague at my workplace, we had a lot of contact via email, but we hadn't really met in person. And then we bumped into each other on the corridor, and she said, "Oh, Edgar, it's very nice to finally meet you. I would really like to just introduce myself." So she introduced herself, and then we went to my office and we were chatting there. And one of the I said, "Well, I'm married and I've been living here in Edinburgh for so many years, and I've been done this." And then she asked me, "Oh, are you married to a guy or a woman or And she said it in a very light-hearted way. It felt effortless. It was just natural in the conversation that she asked me, "Are you married to a guy or a woman?" But I realized later that it was the very first time in my whole life that someone had asked me, "Are you in a relationship with a guy or a woman?" So many times there is this assumption that I am straight, or that I should be straight, or that I am part of this straight community. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know how clueless they are.
No, it's interesting. Because when you were talking then, and I feel ashamed for saying this, because if somebody said they were married, at what point would I then ask the gender of the partner? And my mind would be automatically going, oh, they're married to a woman.
Yes, yes.
And that makes me feel bad and ashamed. And, you know, where does that come from?
Well, it comes from heteronormativity. That is heteronormativity at its best. Because it's...
Or its worst.
Well, yeah, at its worst. I think it is... It's one of those very subtle moments when you see how powerful it is, because I've realized that sometimes when, well, and you know, you talk about the gaydar and you, that you, whether you know if someone is gay or not, just by the interaction. And sometimes when you have certain doubt or, oh, is this person straight or gay? It's when you ask, or when you, at least in your head, you ask, oh, is this person in a relationship with a guy or a woman? Or... But I think what this woman did, my colleague did, was this very inclusive, very equalitarian interaction, just by asking naturally, so are you into guys, women, or people? So I think it was really nice. I loved it. I really loved it. And I think I want to ask that more. It should be a rather common question.
Well, my guess is two places. One is, I do remember this now, growing up, been in, my mind goes to business meetings and always checking out the men's fingers if they had a wedding ring or not, because then I knew if to sexualize or desexualize them. So I was always mindful when I met a guy I was attracted to was to check the finger. And if he had a wedding ring, until very recently, that meant he was married to a woman, therefore I could bracket him.
As straight, inaccessible, or...
Yeah, and it's just, I'm amazed that I'm now... And I'm just thinking then, if I ask, I'm nervous to ask a man, less so with a woman, but if I ask a man, are you married to a man or a woman, that I'd get a negative response, that he'd be offended by that question.
But that would be his problem.
Yes, but it also that would then locate us in a different position, who he thinks I'm gay. And again, that's my problem, isn't it? But I'm just, thank you for raising this, just what the tensions are going on for me. You know, the wedding ring no longer is a symbol of heterosexuality, but also my fear of asking somebody in case they get offended.
And I mean, why should they be offended? It is I mean, if they are offended, that would be just blatant homophobia.
But remember the culture I grew up in, which was it was unspoken. For me, I'm now having to break a very strong narrative clearly in my mind that wedding ring equals heterosexuality. And this discussion is just helping me break that down a wee bit.
Yeah, and we are realizing that now that is no longer valid, that it's wedding ring can mean married to a man or a woman. Or
I think it's important to say we Egg and I both understand they're not just two genders. We are using binary terms there. We do appreciate that maybe some of our queer listeners would want to challenge that, so we're on board with that.
I think this just shows how constrained we are, in the sense that legally there are only two genders that are recognised, and that is very limiting, and I acknowledge the limits of that because I work with trans people in counselling, and I am aware of all this in-betweenness that it's and all this inapplicability of binary terms.
So if you're experiencing our conversation as binary, that's not our intent to offend or upset everyone, but I guess we're just reflecting maybe something that goes on for us in terms of discourse and gender.
Yes.
Can I ask you a question then? In terms of, so you're in a meeting with a man with a wedding ring. At what point do you ask that question? Do you, at the point where, oh, is he gay? And you want clarity? Or would you ask it universally? Or would you use it as a mechanism of outing yourself?
I must say that this interaction is very, very recent, and I haven't had that opportunity to say it as naturally as this woman asked it. So I am purposefully saying I'm going to do it. I haven't done it yet because I haven't met anybody new, or I haven't met anybody who...
Would you be cheekily ask it to somebody who you knew was married to a woman?
No, if I know, why should I? If I know they are married. I think if it's relevant to the conversation, I could definitely ask. If it's not relevant to the conversation, then no. But I think it's a challenge that I want for myself, because I see it as a very small but meaningful act of resistance to heteronormativity.
I'm thinking then when we do, or certainly when I do, assessments for counselling for potential clients, and we ask about their relationship status and that, oh, I'm married, I don't then naturally follow it up with the gender question. But that sounds quite important now.
Because it is part of your life. I just recently saw a thread on Twitter that was saying, let's stop referring to being gay or being lesbian or being trans as a private matter, because it's not a private matter, it's part of our lives. And I think that is one of the challenges of this day and age, when you need to introduce it in discourse as something that is common, and the more common it gets, the easier it will be for everyone.
And that's a really interesting point. It brings us back to the whole premise of this podcast, which is the everydayness of gay life. And rather than having these big events, you know, coming out, and we're constantly coming out, we don't just come out once in our lives.
Yes, absolutely.
And what you're saying then is actually part of the everydayness of gay life then is asking the questions, you know? Married. Oh, gosh, I'm just curious, what gender is your partner, you know? And that is then, as you say, embedding gayness in everyday life.
I attended a workshop last year on equality at the workplace. It was a talk by Ben Lyon. He works for Transport for London. And he was saying that it's very important to introduce all this terminology and talking about LGBTQ people at the workplace, because if you do it, then you are including them in the, as part of the work culture. And I think that is really good. So part of what Ben was doing was these campaigns for the buses, like making it very visible in the at the subway, at the buses, and so just, we are important, and we are part of the workplace. And I think that is really important, that being gay doesn't need to be limited to your private life.
And I guess the other extreme then is private, you know, the private life, but I'm also interested in is when it's overly emphasised. And I wonder, maybe this is a conversation for another podcast, is the role of these organisations within the workplace of LGBT? And actually, is that always beneficial, that somehow it's made special and different by doing that? And actually, does a sophisticated organisation not require an LGBT association to the extent that some organisations do? That if it's part of everyday culture, the need for it to be separate diminishes? And I get the need for shared experiences and to have that camaraderie, but not necessarily to make it a special thing.
I see, yes. I think there will be a point when there won't be any need for that. And hopefully that will be very soon, because that would mean, oh, success. We are part of the culture in general. I mean, we are, but it's a... integrated.
Maybe it's a conversation, as I say, it feels like a big topic, so we can chat about it in the future, but hopefully those organisations that do have these LGBT groups within them, I hope they're also asking on their application forms, and they're asking people, if you're married, the gender of the partner. Because that's the everydayness that you and I support.
Yes, yes.
Rather than having these special events where it's, you know, and difference and diversity awareness workshops, and God, I've been to a few, but then it doesn't work through to the everyday context.
So yes, you just introduce it in, in official document. And I can see that there would be some resistance from some people, could be, because probably they would say, I prefer not to say, which is fine, but it's good to be asked.
Yes, and as you're talking there, I'm thinking, let's make that a thing for a future podcast, a topic for a future podcast, you know, the role of LGBTQ as a label, as as an acronym going forward, if that's useful, because I have problems with that term, but let's discuss that in the future.
Now, you want more tea?
Well, we do a bit this time. Yeah, yes, please. Oh, good.
It's going well, I think. Probably we just need to go back to the relationship, because
we drifted away, that's fine.
And I mean, it's fine, because that is part of the conversation, what we do.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's nice to have some drift and then come back, but I think, we just need a bit more around that. So Neil and you are going tomorrow.
We're flying via Air France.
I'm talking to Oscar later today.
Oh, I need to watch.
It's half nothing.
The process takes 4 months, and we needed someone to go. I think it would be a year or something.
Let's see. But it pays the bills.
I would say go for it.
Thank you. Very nice tea, that. Is that Wittards?
It's a very nice brand that they have introduced. So they have shops all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called Divana.
Mm-hmm.
And they have very quirky tea pots and
nice.
Cups. And they make fantastic tea. So I want to bring some tea as well and infusions. So we started by making this difference between romantic and erotic, and I think I really didn't speak about the erotic aspect. Why do I say erotic rather than sexual? And I think that is a part of resisting a narrative that says that we are just sexual, and I think there is more to us gay men than just the mechanics of it, because the sexual aspect sounds like the phallocentric penetration, like a pure mechanics penetration, penis, anus. And I think the erotic aspect involves something more, some sort of connectedness beyond the sexual.
So sexual is mechanical, it's putting the body through the act of sex.
Yes.
Whereas erotic has some emotional dimension to it, that the mind, the thoughts and the feelings are brought into the act of sex.
Exactly, yes, that you can be aroused by someone's conversation. Even if it's an exchange on Grindr, even if you are just starting to hook up, that exchange and that teasing and that sense of excitement, I would argue that the erotic starts from that connection between the minds, and then that can surpass the bodily aspects of the encounter, because so many times you might be turned on by a fabulous body, a person whose attractiveness, physical attractiveness is undeniable. But then the interaction might not be as exciting. And sometimes you can have a conversation that just turns you on immediately. And then the physique of the person might not be as important. So I would argue that the erotic involves your mind, your emotions, your affects. So
it's almost as if erotic overcomes the mind-body split.
Yes, exactly. Yes, the erotic allows you to connect. And Audre Lorde writes about this, a feminist writer. She says that we've been oppressed in the sense of the erotic being equated to the sexual. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you are saying. The erotic overcomes that split between mm-hmm. body and mind. Mm-hmm. And fabulous, fabulous book, Sister Outsider, mm. essays by Audre Lorde. She talks about the deceiving narrative of the sexual, making us believe that is the erotic, and not the erotic is a constructive force that goes way beyond the mechanics mm-hmm. of sex.
Mm. And that's Descartes, isn't it, who talks about the mind,
yes.
body split. So it feels like we're talking about that from different authors' perspectives, different mm-hmm. people's mm-hmm. different theories. And maybe that's what legalisation of gay marriage allows us, what is beginning to happen in the gay discourse, is that connection of mind and body, because we've now got the legal freedom, or the cultural freedom, discursive freedom to do that.
Yeah, yes and no. I would say yes, because that now is validated by the state, by society, and it's fine. Mm-hmm. But I would say that gay men having had these connections before that, even when it wasn't allowed, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. even if it was against the law, but you could still have these connections. And I would say that there is also this potential for the erotic happening in a one-off sexual encounter. Mm. It can be, because I don't want to say that in order to have meaningful erotic encounters or intimate relationships that you need to be in a marriage or that you need to be mm-hmm. in a long-term mm. relationship. Because you can have that meaningful encounter in one of those hookups if you just mm-hmm. allow yourself. And it can finish there. It can be just that shared. It can be the weekend experience that we were talking mm-hmm. about in the beginning. It mm-hmm. can be just those 48 hours mm-hmm. that make you connect.
And they're often, I don't know about you, but for me, those erotic interactions can be often with men who, on paper, I would not have been attracted to. They don't necessarily have the, you know, you spoke about, you know, the culturally stereotypical gay body that is seen as more attractive. That there's been some emotional connection, and it's caught me by surprise at times. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That actually it happened with that particular individual, because gosh, where did that come from? You know, that didn't fit a checklist that, you know, those websites reduces to.
Yes. So the sexual capital that you were talking about last episode.
And of course, that sexual capital then doesn't necessarily translate to emotional capital. Two different, you know, from last week, Bardozian feels mm-hmm. that we're talking about there. So, yeah, and the erotic is bringing those two aspects together. Mm-hmm. It's bringing the sexual and the emotional, maybe for the first time, together. And that goes back to, you know, childhood experiences where they had to be kept separate and suppressed. Mm.
Wrapping up.
For me, thank you. This conversation went to places that I didn't expect it to. The notion of the wedding ring mm. and what that's been a symbol for me of, a symbol of suppression, mm. of desexualisation. Mm. And that today's conversation has really made me challenge my own thinking about that. I'm not going to go away and think about, you know, the times when I would be comfortable asking the gender question.
Yes.
Afterwards, so thank you mm. for that. And then also thinking about mind-body separation and how the term erotic takes us to a more broader understanding than possibly mm. sex, and the emphasis that sex has in gay culture allows us to.
Yes, the erotic as a force that connects.
Mm-hmm. And for you, what's come up for you in our conversation today?
It's been a conversation that shows me I have power to resist broader mm. powerful narratives, mm-hmm. powerful discourses, and how we as gay men have been told who we are, we have been told how we behave. We have been told that we are sexual beings and mm-hmm. that we enjoy certain things. And this has happened as a very complex phenomenon. I can't really explain how it has happened. I can't explain it fully. But what it has come across for me in this conversation is that these simple acts, these very ordinary acts that we can all perform, mm-hmm. that we can all ask questions, we can all talk about being gay, we can all talk about what we feel, we can talk about our relationships, mm-hmm. we can talk about this apparent split of romance and sex, mm-hmm. and we can all try to find both in mm-hmm. one person. Mm-hmm. And for me, it is the simple acts of resistance mm-hmm. in our everyday lives. Mm-hmm.
And to resist, you need to be aware.
Yes.
And that hopefully is what's come out of today's awareness of what different discourses we plug ourselves into, mm-hmm. Almost like the Matrix.
Yes.
Subconsciously. Mm-hmm. And that we can actually take a step back and, like the Matrix, we can begin to resist.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you.
We will catch up with you in a month's time. As we said at the beginning, please feel free to join the conversation. Send us messages, emails, mm-hmm. What's come up for you listening to us, and ideas for future shows.
Yes, and if you, an open invitation, if you want to form part of this podcast. For now, if you are based in Edinburgh, please, you face can just face. Join mm-hmm. us in this conversation face to face. And later, I don't know what you think about this, Jason, but later we could do the podcast in other parts of the...
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
See you next time.
Bye.